Screaming Jenny. The old storage sheds along the tracks were abandoned shortly after the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad was built, and it wasn't long before the poor folk of the area moved in. The sheds provided shelter of a sort, although the winter wind still pierced through every crevice, and the small fireplaces that the poor constructed did little to keep the cold at bay. A gentle, kindly woman named Jenny lived alone in one of the smaller sheds. She had fallen on hard times, and with no family to protect her, she was forced to find work where she could and take whatever shelter was available to someone with little money. Jenny never had enough to eat, and in winter her tiny fire barely kept her alive during the cold months. Still, she kept her spirits up and tried to help other folks when they took sick or needed food, sometimes going without herself so that another could eat. One cold evening in late autumn, Jenny sat shivering over her fire, drinking broth out of a wooden bowl, when a spark flew from the fire and lit her skirts on fire. Intent on filling her aching stomach, Jenny did not notice her flaming clothes until the fire had burnt through the heavy wool of her skirt and began to scorch her skin. Leaping up in terror, Jenny threw her broth over the licking flames, but the fluid did nothing to douse the fire. In terror, Jenny fled from the shack and ran along the tracks, screaming for help as the flames engulfed her body. The station was not far away, and instinctively Jenny made for it, hoping to find someone to aid her. Within moments, her body was a glowing inferno and Jenny was overwhelmed by pain. Her screams grew more horrible as her steps slowed. She staggered blindly onto the tracks just west of the station, a ball of fire that barely looked human. In her agony, she did not see the glowing headlight of the train rounding the curve, or hear the screech of the brakes as the engineer spotted her fire-eaten figure and tried to stop. A moment later, her terrible screams broke off as the train mowed her down. Alerted by the whistle, the crew from the station came running as the engineer halted the train and ran back down the tracks toward poor dead Jenny, who was still burning. The men doused the fire and carried her body back to the station. She was given a pauper's funeral and buried in an unmarked grave in the local churchyard. Within a few days, another poverty-stricken family had moved into her shack, and Jenny was forgotten. Forgotten, that is, until a month later when a train rounding the bend west of the station was confronted by a screaming ball of fire. Too late to stop, the engineer plowed over the glowing figure before he could bring the train to a screeching halt. Leaping from the engine, he ran back down the tracks to search for a mangled, burning body, but there was nothing there. Shaken, he brought his train into the station and reported the incident to the station master. After hearing his tale, the station master remembered poor, dead Jenny and realized that her ghost had returned to haunt the tracks where she had died. To this day, the phantom of Screaming Jenny still appears on the tracks on the anniversary of the day she died. Many an engineer has rounded the curve just west of the station and found himself face to face with the burning ghost of Screaming Jenny as once more she makes her deadly run towards the Harper's Ferry station, seeking in vain for someone to save her. Storm Hag. She lurks below the surface of the lake near Presque Isle, her lithe form forever swimming through the weeds and the mire. Pale and green of skin, her yellow eyes shine luminously in the dark, and her thin long arms wrap themselves around the unwary, while foul green pointed teeth sink into soft flesh and sharp nails at the end of long bony fingers stroke you into the deepest sleep there is. She is called by many names, but to sailors of Lake Erie, she is known as the Storm Hag. The creature is a sea witch, an evil Jenny Greenteeth who summoned the storms and pulled shipwrecked sailors down into her evil embrace to live with her forever at the bottom of the lake. Sometimes she waits until the calm right after the storm to attack. When the sailors relax their guard, lulled into thinking that the danger had passed with the Storm Hag bursts forth from the dark waters of the lake, spewing forth lightning and wind like venom. And the ship will vanish, never to be seen again. There is only one warning before she strikes. If you listen closely, you can hear her singing against the harsh wind and the thrashing waves. Come into the water, love. Dance beneath the waves. Where dwell the bones of sailor lads? Inside my saffron cave. If you can, flee immediately, for but the storm hag is right beside you. If you cannot, then pray to your god for mercy, for the storm hag will grant you none. Her whirlpool will suck down your ship, and her long green arms will lovingly stroke you into the depths of the lake, where she will feast on your body among the weeds. Vampire Hermit. She was nervous when her husband said they were to stay in the abandoned house, for it contained the corpse of the hermit who once lived there, enshrined in a coffin in the loft. It was an old custom and one no longer popular among the Iroquois people, but the hermit had insisted upon it before his death. There was good hunting in this place, her man had declared, and so they moved in and she unpacked their few belongings in the front room, refusing to go up into the loft where the hermit's body lay. When her husband left to hunt, she immediately put her daughter in the sling on her back and went to look for roots and berries, staying away until her husband returned with the meat. As she prepared the evening meal for them, her husband, tired from his hunting, climbed up into the loft to rest. The hut soon filled with the delicious smell of roasting meat. She was sorting through the berries when she heard a muffled cry and the crunch of breaking bones. As she stared upward, frozen in horror, blood started to drip from the rafters. She crept silently to the far corner of the room where she could see up into the loft. A skeleton with glowing red eye sockets was feasting on the body of her husband, its teeth and chin covered with blood. Her daughter stirred restlessly at her back, and she knew that she had to get away immediately. "I am going to run down to the stream to fetch water for the broth," she called toward the loft. "I will be right back." She took the pail and walked toward the stream, trying to appear normal. As soon as she was out of sight among the trees, she started to run as fast as she could. She heard a terrible howl from the direction of the house as the creature heard them escaping and started to pursue. The young mother stumbled desperately through the woods, the creature's howls growing closer as it pursued them. Her little daughter wailed in fright at her back as she fled in terror, sobbing and was almost without hope the monster was gaining on her. In a last act of despair, she shouted the Iroquois distress cry, hoping someone would be near enough to hear it. Her call was taken up and answered by the warriors from the village. She could hear the creature breathing behind her as she sprinted to the trees at the edge of the village. Here, her strength failed her, and she collapsed to the ground. Just before the monster could pounce on them, a party of warriors burst through the gates of the village, chasing the skeleton away. They swung their torches wide, and the skeleton retreated farther into the woods. The warriors chased the creature back to the hermit's house and set fire to the cabin. As the flames encompassed the house, a terrible howling and roaring came from the loft, and the vampire hermit fled into the woods in the form of a rabbit, never again to plague the young woman or her daughter. Vengeance. When the samurai warrior Kane first came to California from Tokyo, B brought his new wife, the beautiful Ishii. She was an ideal wife, gentle, attentive, and a wonderful cook. Kane was the envy of his new neighbors. But he was a proud man. When a wealthy family moved into the neighborhood, Kane cast his eye upon their lovely daughter, Aiko, and desired her. In his mind, Ishii was second best. So Kane plotted to rid himself of his wife so he could woo and win the fair Aiko. On a stormy night on the way home from a great banquet, Kane pushed Ishii over the cliff and into the bay. No one heard her scream though the howling wind. No one suspected foul play when Kane came rushing back to the banquet hall, shouting for help because his poor wife had slipped and fallen over the cliff. Kane acted the part of the bereaved husband to perfection. He gave Ishii a splendid funeral. It wasn't until he was alone in his house that Kane relaxed and drank to his success. Outside, the wind whipped against the house, making the walls rattle and shake. A stray breeze swept through the sleeping room with a whisper, "Vengeance! Vengeance!" Kane sat up and blinked as a dark figure stepped into the room. Its long, tangled black hair hung over the dirty, blood-stained kimono. Its face was crushed and broken, with one eyeball hanging from the socket. The ghost of Ishii reached out a broken hand toward her husband, smiling through the shattered remains of her teeth. "Vengeance," she whispered, "vengeance." Kane screamed in terror, leapt out of the window, and ran to a neighbor's house. Mistaking his fear for grief, the neighbors took him in and insisted he stay with them during the first weeks of his bereavement. A month passed as Kane waited for Ishii's ghost to reappear, but she vanished. Relieved, Kane decided it was safe to bring Aiko and her family to see his home. As he escorted Aiko's parents around the garden, he felt a hand on his arm. Kane turned around and found himself facing a beautiful Ishii, who kissed him and whispered in his ear, "Vengeance." Laughing, Ishii danced away, waving to Aiko and her parents as she passed. Aiko glared after her in jealous rage. Fearing that Aiko might end the betrothal, Kane pressed forward with his suit, arranging for a grand engagement feast to prove his devotion. Friends, neighbors, and family came to the banquet hall to laugh and toast over food and wine. Kane was very pleased with his success. But when he looked across the hall, he saw the ghost of beautiful young Ishii walk into the room and stand demurely in the corner. He paused mid-sentence and stared in horror as she laughed and began to change. Her body twisted and broke before Kane's eyes, her face collapsing inward and bleeding, her black hair tangling, her eyeball popping out of its socket. "Vengeance," she whispered. "No! No!" Kane shouted. Around him, Akio, her parents, and the guests stared. None of them could see the ghost. As Ishii drifted out of the door, Kane followed, vowing she would haunt him no more. The ghost drifted along the cliff path with Kane running after her, shouting and cursing. Suddenly, the ghost stopped at the place where Kane had pushed her. She turned to face Kane and started to grow, her crushed body bloody and dirty, her eyeball swaying, her shattered teeth gleaming in the moonlight. "Vengeance," she screamed and lunged at Kane. The samurai stepped backward, face contorting in fear. His foot slipped suddenly on the loose earth, and he plunged backward over the edge of the cliff, his body fatally smashing into the rocks far below. That same night, a terrible storm beat against Kane's house. Lightning hit the roof and the house burned to the ground. Neighbors claimed they could hear a voice in the wind saying one word, over and over, "Vengeance. Where's my liver?" "Go straight to the store and don't fool around," his mother said sternly as she handed over the money. "Your father's boss is coming to dinner tonight and we're having his favorite meal of liver and onions. It's important that we make a good impression, so get the best liver they've got."
"I will, Ma," Tommy sulked. His mother had really been after him since he brought home a failing report card. Tommy grabbed his bicycle from the garage and rode down Nen Street. Then saw his friend Chad.
"Come on, Tommy,"
Chad called.
"The gang's playing baseball over at the park, and we need a pitcher."
Immediately, all thoughts of his errand fled from Tommy's mind. The boys headed towards the park. Tommy pitched a no-hitter to win the game for his team, but by the time it was over, it was dark. Then Tommy remembered his errand.
"The liver," he gasped.
"I've got to get to the store."
But all the local groceries were closed.
"My mom's going to kill me," he gasped. First the bad report card, and now this. He would be grounded for life. As he rode home past the cemetery, he got an idea. It was an awful idea, but it would save him from the even more awful fate that awaited him if he came home without a liver. His great uncle had died a few days ago and had been buried in the cemetery. What harm would it do to remove it? His uncle certainly didn't need it anymore. Tommy hurried home as silently as he could and got his father's shovel. He returned to the cemetery and began digging up his great uncle's grave. That night, his mother cooked up the liver and onions, and the boss raved about the meal and had such a good time that he didn't leave until quite late. Tommy went to bed that night relieved he had gotten away with it. He fell asleep almost as soon as his head hit the pillow, but woke with a start soon after, sure that he had heard a voice.
"Where's my liver?"
A ghostly voice rose up from the staircase, deep and guttural. Tommy gasped in fear and flung himself under the covers as the thud of heavy footsteps reached the top of the steps.
Thump. Thump. Thump.
The footsteps drew nearer until they reached Tommy's door. "Who's got my liver?" the horrible voice asked again.
"Go away. Go away," Tommy whispered repeatedly.
His whole body trembled in terror as once more the voice asked, "Where's my liver? Who's got my liver?" Sheer terror made him suddenly bolt.
Tommy threw back the covers and found the shriveled white face of his great uncle right above him.
"We eat your liver," he shouted.
"I know you did, Tommy," the rotting corpse of his great uncle said softly, stretching out his bony hands toward the boy's shaking body.
Tommy screamed. The next morning, Tommy's parents discovered their son lying dead on top of his bed. His liver had been ripped right out of his body, but the autopsy proved that the boy had already died of fright before his liver was removed.
White Lady.
In the early 1800s, the White Lady and her daughter were supposed to have lived on the land where the Durand Easement Park part of Irondequoit and Rochester now stands. One day, the daughter disappeared. Convinced that the girl had been raped and murdered by a local farmer, the mother searched the marshy lands day after day, trying to discover where her child's body was buried. She took with her two German Shepherd dogs to aid in her search, but she never found a trace of her daughter. Finally, in her grief, the mother threw herself off a cliff into Lake Ontario and died. Her dogs pined for their mistress and shortly joined her in the grave. After death, the mother's spirit returned to continue the search for her child. People say that on foggy nights, the White Lady rises from the small Durand Lake which faces Lake Ontario. She is accompanied by her dogs and together they roam through the Durand Easement Park, still searching for her missing daughter. The White Lady is not a friendly spirit. She dislikes men and often seeks vengeance against the males visiting the park on her daughter's behalf. There have been reports of the White Lady chasing men into the lake, shaking their cars, and making their lives miserable until they leave the park. She has never touched any females accompanying these unfortunate fellows.
White Wolf.
She snapped awake out of a deep sleep, screaming aloud in terror. In her nightmare, a large white wolf had been chasing her around and around the house, gaining on her with every step until it finally pounced on her and ripped out her throat. She lay shaking for hours, unable to sleep after such a terrifying dream. But morning finally arrived, and the day was completely normal. Celia forgot all about her dream until the moment her parents reminded her that they would be going out that night to celebrate their anniversary. Celia turned milk white. In her dream, the white wolf had come to kill her while her parents were out celebrating their anniversary. She started shaking and begging them not to go. Her parents were astonished at her behavior and finally shamed her into staying home alone that night. Fearfully, Celia locked herself into the house as soon as her parents left, checking every door and every window. She tried to laugh it off as she got into bed, and finally she shook off her irrational fear and fell asleep. Celia snapped awake suddenly, every muscle tense. She heard the tinkling of falling glass from a broken window and the snuffling sound of a snout pressed to the floor. It was the sound of a hunting wolf. A werewolf. Real wolves did not break into houses when there was plenty of game outside. She could hear the click-clicking of the creature's claws on the wooden floor. The musky, foul smell of wet animal fur combined with the meaty breath of a carnivore drifted into the room. She could hear the werewolves panting right outside her bedroom. Then her body was out of bed and she sped through the bathroom and down the back stairs. She heard a soft growl and then the sound of animal feet pursuing her as she raced down the steps and tore open the back door. A glance at the window beside her showed a reflection of the werewolf leaping down the last few steps behind her. Celia's feet screamed in protest as she ran painfully across the sharp gravel driveway toward the tool shed with its shovels and baseball bats. Anything she could use as a weapon. But the huge, red-eyed wolf was suddenly between her and the tool shed, stalking toward her. The cold wind pierced her skin as she turned and fled around the side of the house. She gasped as the white wolf howled and took off after her.
She could hear the terrifying sound of the creature's pounding feet. Faster, faster, she commanded her legs, panting desperately against the fear choking her. She would run around the house and back down the driveway, she thought with the clarity of sheer horror. She felt the wolf snap at her back leg and felt the sting of teeth. She put on speed. The wolf veered away from her suddenly, and she felt a rush of hope. She couldn't hear the wolf now, couldn't see it in the cloud darkened night. She kept running around the house, heading back toward the tool shed. To her intense relief, she heard the sound of a car coming down the road in front of her house. Her parents were back and would save her from the wolf. Then her heart stopped in panic as she turned the last corner and saw the shape of the white wolf as it stood balanced on the porch railing right in front of her. It sprang upon Celia, huge teeth tearing into her flesh and ripping at her throat. She fell under the weight of its body, hot blood spilling all over the ground, and died seconds after she hit the ground. 1 minute later, her parents' car pulled into the driveway, its headlights blinding the white wolf as it pulled toward the house. Frightened, the wolf backed away from its kill and then ran away. Wrath of the Creek. When he left his tribe to work with the white lumberman, he changed his name to William Cloud, and the lumberjacks started calling him Cloudy. They liked to hear Cloudy tell the story of the wraith that lived in the creek that powered the local log chute. The wraith was an evil creature that desired nothing more than to wrap its long arms around humans or animals and pull them down into the water to drown. It rained heavy and long that spring, and the creek was flooded almost to capacity. One stormy night, the order was given to lower the gate of the chute and send the logs downstream to the mill. The thought of going outside in the storm did not appeal to anyone, and so the men drew straws. Cloudy came up with the short one. He hugged his coat tightly around him as he made his way silently through the pitch-black night toward the log chute. As he released the first pin, he heard a foul hissing sound from beside the floating raft of logs. Cloudy turned his head and saw a grotesque form rising from the swirling stream. Its face was framed by wild, weed-strewn hair, and dark, slimy scales covered its lithesome body. Cloudy tugged frantically at the final pin, eager to finish his task and get away. But the pin got stuck halfway out. Suddenly, the creature lunged out of the water. Cloudy leapt back, fleeing up the path toward the cabin. Behind him, the wraith howled. Cloudy increased his speed, running blindly in the darkness. Then the wraith dropped down from the branches of a tree right in front of him, blocking his way. Its yellow eyes glowed, and moonlight glinted against its slimy skin. Its long, thin arms stretched out toward him through the raging storm, claws extended. He gave one loud shout of despair, but the lightning-fast movement of a razor-sharp claw cut off his cry, and the woods were suddenly still again. Back in the cabin, the lumberman waited for Cloudy to return. Then Ethan, Cloudy's good friend, volunteered to go down to the log chute and look for him. Several other loggers decided to join the search. Within 10 minutes, the men were standing next to the gate. They lowered a lantern to the level of the rushing water and peered into the depths. Ethan gave a sudden sharp cry when he spotted the mangled face of Cloudy. The loggers lifted the gate and drew Cloudy up with pike poles. His body had been sliced to ribbons, and his head was almost completely severed. News of the murderous wraith in the creek quickly spread through the lumber camp. A week after Cloudy's death, Ethan was awakened by a strange blue light above his bed. He opened his eyes and found himself gazing into the face of William Cloud. The spirit warned Ethan that the wraith had marked Ethan for its next victim. At daybreak, Ethan packed his belongings and left the camp. On his way out, he confided his story to a few of the lumbermen, and soon word of Cloudy's warning spread throughout the camp. By sundown, it was completely deserted. The log chute fell into disrepair and slowly crumbled away, never to be replaced. The wraith still lurks in the stream, watching for another victim. But it waits in vain, for the ghost of Cloudy appears to anyone foolish enough to wander near the stream, warning them away with terrible groans and piercing screams.